Last night we looked at what the New Testament has to say about the Christian's relationship to the law. And this evening we're going to look at a specific portion of the law, namely Exodus chapter 21 and 22, to understand a little bit about what values we can gain from the Old Testament law, since indeed we are made dead to the law through the body of Christ, and yet the New Testament clearly teaches that the law has value as an instructive document for us so that we can be thoroughly prepared for every good work. It's profitable for instruction and doctrine and correction and reproof. And as we look at these chapters, remember that the focus is not to try to find some rules, some regulations, but the focus is to understand God better and to understand how God feels about things, to understand how God thinks about the tangles that human beings get into. Now let's notice some general values of the Old Testament law. First of all, it demonstrates a proper response to redemption. Exodus 20, verse 1, notice what God says. "And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me." Now notice the connection there. I'm the one who brought you out of Egypt. I brought you out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. Why is that so important, tied together? Because God, in the plagues he put on Egypt, was essentially beating up all of the false gods of Egypt. They had a god called the Nile River, and God turned that into blood. They had a sacred bull, and the bull couldn't keep the bugs off of him. They had a god of the frog, and the frog went out of control, came up over everything. They had a sun god. God made it dark for 3 days. Pharaoh claimed to be a god. He couldn't save his own firstborn. So again and again, God said, I beat this god, this god, this god, this god. Now, only a foolish person would have another god beside one who can do that kind of stuff. You shall have no other gods before me. And so when we understand redemption, they were redeemed out of Egypt, then a proper response can be seen in Exodus 20, verses 3 and following. You might also glance, if you like, at some later point, how you have a historical summary in Deuteronomy 1 through 4 before the Ten Commandments are repeated in Deuteronomy 5. And so you can see that what God has done leads up to how we should respond to what God has done. The Old Testament law centers on God. In other words, you're to have no other gods because that will produce a different ethical system. You see, one of the reasons God did not want them to have other gods was those gods were vicious and terrible. They were sexually perverted. They were desiring human sacrifice. And so God naturally did not want his people to get involved in that because people become like the god they worship. And they were to make no graven image. That is, a graven image to represent God, because really God is alive, not dead, and God is represented by the living image, namely man, that he made in his own image. Then when you look at the uncleanness laws, what is the purpose of those? I think the major purpose is it addresses the common human fault of thinking that I am not so bad. And the uncleanness laws resulted in repeatedly experiencing being unclean ceremonially just by ordinary things that happen in life, even things that are right and good. For example, after childbirth, which we know is a good action by a woman, she was unclean for a specified amount of time. The Old Testament law also enabled an exhibition to the surrounding nations to exhibit to the nations what is God like. Israel was to imitate God. And if you like, you can see this in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 12 to 19. What does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you today for your good. Indeed, heaven and the highest heavens belong to the Lord your God, also the earth with all that is in it. The Lord delighted only in your fathers, to love them, and he chose their descendants after them, you above all peoples, as it is this day. Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore, love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Notice, he lists the characteristics of God, says what he's like, and he mentions specifically loving the stranger, and then he says, therefore love the stranger. That's giving us a picture of what God is like and what we are supposed to do, imitate God. And so how does redeemed society work? Redeemed society works by this, the best word I can think of is paradigm. I'm going to explain what paradigm means so that if you're not familiar with that word, I don't have to keep explaining it over and over. If you're trying to learn a foreign language, you have a list of words like I love, you love, he loves, we love, you love, they love. And you say that in the foreign language, and that gives you a standard pattern of how to form that verbal system in the foreign language. That pattern is called a paradigm. It means here's the way you do it for the word love, but it's not saying that's the only word you do it for. You do it for all those kind of words that have that basic kind of format and how they work. And so you learn that paradigm, and that helps you know how to apply it in lots and lots and lots of cases. In other words, the law is a paradigm. It's not a slavish literalism, but it's something that is sort of a pattern to give you an idea, this is how something works. And so redeemed society is to work like God describes in the Old Testament. But it's not that it's only those specific things, and since you didn't miss this one, then I can do what I want on that one. What are the general values that we see in particular in Exodus 21 and 22? Well, first of all, it demonstrates the requirements of God. The law is representative and illustrates basic principles. The title in Exodus 21 says, "Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them." The judgments represent a legal terminology. It's like if you have a court case and a decision is made, that's a judgment. It's a legal precedent. This is a judgment God has made about how to deal with this situation. So God's moral will can be seen in the Old Testament, and we know that his moral will applies to the church as well. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 9 and 10. You remember we looked at that the other evening where Paul is talking about the support of those who teach the Word of God, and he said about how in the Old Testament it says that you shall not muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. And so he says God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Did he write this for us? And he says, yes, he wrote it for us. So that means we go back to these kind of laws and learn something about God's requirements and God's ideas about things. Notice also that God's principles are enshrined in life. They are not just some mere vague theory. Exodus 20 has the Ten Commandments, and then the chapters that follow do an expansion, in essence, on those Ten Commandments and tell you more details about what's going on so you understand it better. That shows that detailed obedience is important. And also notice that as you read through these laws, God does not make a distinction between religious experience and secular experience. spiritual and secular. I mean, you have some laws that look very secular. You know, it's how you deal with your ox, for example. And right beside it might be some laws that deal with how you're supposed to do something when you go to the tabernacle. These different types of laws are intermingled. Furthermore, as you read these chapters and on into other chapters in addition, not just 21 and 22, you'll find that he wants us to focus on human values rather than material values. For example, no property offense merited the death penalty. That was a contrast to ancient Near Eastern law. You could have property damage and then have death penalty for that. Chapter 21, verse 16, kidnapping was essentially converting a man to property, and so it required the death penalty. Now, we should learn from this. You see, if God is saying focus on human rather than material values, Christian organizations sometimes fall down here and they will use people and mistreat them in order to achieve Christian goals of the Christian program that the church may be involved in. That's a huge problem. A theme that you can notice as you're reading these chapters is how God requires personal responsibility for things. You cannot say, well, I couldn't help it, or this was beyond my control, or that so many people want to say today. So let's look at Exodus 21 and 22 and glance down through it and see what we can learn. Verses 1 to 11 talk about slavery. And in verses 1 to 6, the focus is on a male slave. And you can see there in verse 2 that Hebrew slaves were to be set free after 6 years. In other words, the principle here is that slaves had a right to freedom after a fixed period of time. Verse 5, you have the possibility spoken of a slave who loves his master, and that shows that the master treated him kindly. Now, that tells you something about what God expects of servant-master relationships. You know, sometimes there are strong leaders today that oppress those who are under them. And then you can see in this chapter also there's fairness to both master and slave. For example, if the slave is working for a master and he is offered a woman to have as a wife, he can choose. He can say, well, yes, that sounds good to me. Or he can say, you know what, I do not want to get married while I'm a slave, because if I do, then when my freedom comes up, I cannot go with my wife, and the only option is to stay a slave the rest of my life with her. So you see, you have to make a decision based on reality. What do you want to do? And then each person is held responsible. It's not that the master loses his maiden slave when he sets the person free because he was generous earlier. Verses 7 to 11, you have a female slave. And it talks about a perpetual relationship. It clarifies why she stays with the master, rather, even if she marries. And if you glance at the verses there, you can see that when a man marries a wife, he assumes her obligations. Now let's look at chapter 21, verses 12 to 27. God is dealing with violence here. If someone causes someone else to die, notice that if that happens, chapter 21, verse 12, the death penalty is required. You see, animals can be replaced, but the murder of a man requires the death penalty. If you like to compare verses, you could read Leviticus 24:17 and Leviticus 24:18 and verse 21 also. Now, the exception is that if the death is accidental, a person may flee to the city of refuge. But if a murderer, that is someone who intentionally killed someone, were to flee to the city of refuge and take hold of the altar, let's say, he needs to be taken from there and killed. Chapter 21, verses 12 to 17. Personal responsibility. Violent crimes forfeit life. There can't be excuses, well, I was insane when I did that, or I was drunk when I did that. You know, the common excuses that are used today. There's no stipulation that the penalty changes just because somebody happened to be drunk. Notice the wrong actions here in this paragraph toward parents that require the death penalty. Merely striking your parents required death penalty. Cursing your parents required death penalty. And it's interesting that God views that just as bad as kidnapping or murder. That should be very sobering. I believe many times parents in churches are not careful to uphold God's standard regarding what God expects of children. And so these kind of verses should sober us in helping us see how God views these things. God views disrespect to parents as a very serious matter. He addresses a brawling injury. Some men got into a fight. And notice it specifically says there, one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist. In other words, it sounds like something that arises in a quarrel. It is not a premeditated attack where the person goes and gets a weapon and attacks the person. They got into a fight, got aroused toward each other, and then one hit the other one, and maybe with his fist, or picked up a stone and hit him. And so it's talking about an unpremeditated attack. He has to pay for loss of time. He has to provide for him to be thoroughly healed. Notice that the personal responsibility here, losses due to quarrels are paid by those who inflict those losses, not by the state, not by the community. The brawler is not imprisoned, but he is given responsibility. He needs to pay. What does it say there? He needs to pay him for the loss of his time and provide for him until he is thoroughly healed. I believe we live in a day that is full of irresponsibility, and many times that notion of irresponsibility has rubbed off in the church. And we need to read through these kind of things to get God's mind on these issues. What if a man injures his own slave? If he dies, the man is punished. If he lives a day or two, he is not punished because he is his property. Now, notice, you might say, why is there a bias against slaves? Well, this is similar to a brawling victim. You know, if a man got into a fight and one is injured, then he's punished. Notice the focus of the Mosaic Law is not the elimination of slavery, but limiting the abuses of an existing institution. And this is not talking about assault with a lethal weapon. Verses 22 to 25. He addresses the case of a brawling injury to a pregnant woman. If premature death occurs, he shall pay according to the husband's demands and whatever the judges determine. If injury follows, it will be life for life, eye for eye. And notice, this is the only case that involuntary manslaughter merits the death penalty in the Old Testament law. Now, that's a contrast for refuge from the avenger. You know, if somebody was chopping with an axe and the head flew off and hit someone and killed them, he could run to the city of safety and he would not be executed because it was an accident. You can read about it in Deuteronomy 19, verses 4 to 10. But notice here, if someone is in a brawl and injures a pregnant woman and the child dies, the person who did that is to be executed. In other words, God is the defender of the weak and helpless. That has strong implications regarding abortion, doesn't it? You see, here are things that we should be learning by reading through the Old Testament law, where God says, this is how I want things dealt with. Then you have the famous statement of what's called lex talionis. That's the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. Life for life, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. In other words, it's reasonable response to injury. You might like to compare Leviticus 24, verses 19 and 20. This law about eye for eye and tooth for tooth was a limitation on retribution. In other words, if somebody knocked out your eye, you couldn't knock out both of his eyes. You see, there is to be a legitimate something done to those who destroy things in others. Now, this can teach us something. You know, in the United States, there's just a horrible thing that is going on with aggrandizement through lawsuits. Someone experiences a tiny little injury, and then they say, that I've got psychological damage, I've got all these things, and therefore I should be paid $1 million by this corporation. Probably one of the most famous episodes is about the woman who sued McDonald's because she spilled some settlement of several $1 million. You see, what God says about eye for eye and tooth for tooth and hand for hand shows that is invalid. You cannot use some small injury as an excuse to inflict a big payment from someone else. Verses 26 and 27. What if a man ruins a slave's eye or tooth? The answer is, the eye, of course, represents one of the most valuable organs. The tooth is not nearly as much of consequence. But it shows that any permanent bodily loss demanded that this slave be given his freedom. And so you see, from the eye to the tooth, which isn't near as important as the eye, if that happened, you would lose your slave. He would go free. So you can see it would represent anything that involved permanent bodily mutilation of the slave. Now, if every slave owner knew that any permanent damage to a slave would result in that slave having to be set free, it would sharply curb how he treated his slaves. You can see how God is providing an incentive on doing what is right. And I might make this comment. You know, these laws show how God relates to a fallen world without making robots out of everybody. He says, this is what happens, and this gives you an incentive to do what's right, but God doesn't automatically make it so a person couldn't do some wrong thing. He doesn't engineer it so that when they go to do it, their arm just stops. Chapter 21, verses 28 to 36, it speaks about responsibility for animals. He says, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. But if the ox tended to thrust with its horn in times past, and it has been made known to his owner, and he has not kept it confined, so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. If there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life whatever is imposed on him. Notice, if an ox kills a human being, there is a personal responsibility for dangerous animals. And the penalty is the same as deliberate murder in this sense. In all cases, the ox is to be stoned. You see, the ox murdered a man, if you want to call it that, and so he is to be stoned, and his flesh is not to be eaten. In other words, he's viewed as accursed. Now, what about if it was known that this ox was dangerous? What about that? Notice that if it's known that this ox is dangerous and the owner doesn't deal with it properly, and he kills a man, the owner is to be executed. Or there's a possibility that he could redeem himself by paying money regarding whatever price is imposed on him. Possibly the reason that he could buy his freedom was because it was through carelessness, not that he intentionally wanted to see that other person killed. Now, I think there's some important implications here. Personally, I believe that it's very questionable that Christians should be owners of vicious breeds of dogs. I cannot understand why a Christian would want a vicious dog as an animal on their property, unless they have it in a cage. And why would you want to have a dog in a cage anyway? I mean, some people pride themselves, I've got this dog and it's half wolf. And that thing, is that what you want on your property? Now, what is a dog that's half wolf going to do? He's going to have a lot of wolf genes in him. He's going to think like a wolf. He's going to act like a wolf. And if he gets out sometime and attacks a little child that's 4 years old, what do you think is going to happen? Or what about some of these other nasty breeds? You know, people have actually gotten killed. Children have gotten killed because of these nasty dogs. And they are known to be vicious. What does this passage teach us? God views that very seriously. If God says, even an ox, if it is known to thrust with its horn and the owner doesn't keep it pinned up properly and gets out and kills somebody, that owner should be executed. I believe that would change the complexion of many people's attitudes if they knew that if they're half wolf or their Doberman Pinscher or Rottweiler or whatever got out and attacked somebody and killed them, that they would be executed. It would sort of change their mind as to whether they really wanted to have that animal around. What I'm getting at is, this is not a set of rules that's binding on Christians, but this is a picture of what God thinks about these kind of matters. And I believe Christians should learn from these things. Also, this goring ox, and if he's known with that reputation, and if someone is killed by this ox, the owner should be executed. What does that tell you about habitual breaking speed limit laws? In general, if you're going at an excessive speed, the probability of a serious accident is more or less. More. And so if you're going at an excessive speed, for the conditions, please, and you skid off the road or out of your lane and hit some other vehicle and a person is killed, from this passage, what kind of thing do you think God thinks? I think it has serious implications. Now remember how seriously God views accidental human death. I'm afraid that we in our society don't view it too seriously. Well, this whole thing of driving cars, we love to go fast. And a lot of men, especially men, it seems, are afflicted with this. They think, well, I can go fast and, you know, I just like to go fast and I hope I don't get caught. Well, if excessive speed increases the probability of an accident and increases the seriousness of the accident, we know those kind of things happen because when you're going faster, you have a smaller margin through which to operate. And if something goes wrong, your tire slips off the edge or whatever, you know how that works. It's much more difficult for you to recover from that without an accident. Now remember, God views accidental death so seriously. He says that if you accidentally kill someone in the Old Testament, you were to run for the city of refuge because the avenger is coming, and if he catches you before you get to the city of refuge, you're done. But guess what? You get to the city of refuge, you aren't done yet. You have to stay in that city the rest of your life unless the high priest dies first. Now imagine that. What if you knew that when you went out of this place, when you're driving your car, if you ever have an accident and kill somebody accidentally, that you would have to flee to some little town, let's say down along the edge of Lake Erie, and stay in that little town the rest of your life. And if you ever went out of that town, then the avenger could come and execute you. What would that do to highway driving habits? Have any idea? What I'm getting at is that these passages help us understand how seriously God views accidental cause of human death. I believe we should let those things sink down into our souls. I know a man who figures, I don't need to obey the speed limits. I just won't do it. And he says, if I get caught, I just figure, you know what? The policeman is doing his job. God ordained him to do this, to catch speeders, and so I pay my fine, and I'm glad, and I go on. You know what that is? When you understand how God views accidental deaths, that is not only disobedient to the laws of the state, that is spiritual foolishness. Verses 33 and 34. If you have an open pit resulting in animal deaths, you can't say, well, sorry, that animal should have been using more gumption. He should have been using more wisdom. He shouldn't have fallen in there. If that animal falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make it good. He shall give money to their owner, but the dead animal shall be his. And then 35 and 36, two animals get into a fight. The one man's ox hurts another so that it dies. They shall sell the live ox and divide the money from it, and the dead ox they shall also divide. Or if it was known that the ox tended to thrust in time past, and its owner did not keep it confined, he shall pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall be his. You see how God puts the responsibility on the person who deserves the responsibility. No excuses, no blaming someone else. Chapter 22, verses 1 to 13, he addresses the question of theft. Now remember, in the Ten Commandments, God had said, you shall not steal. But nevertheless, there are people who don't regard what God said, and so they steal. Then what do you do? God tells. There is a penalty for selling or butchering stolen animals. Verse 1. He says, if a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. In other words, there is a responsibility. Restitution includes payment for inconvenience. If there's a voluntary confession, you can read about it in Leviticus 6, verses 4 and 5, and Numbers 5, verses 6 and 7. 20% is added because of the inconvenience. Let's suppose you steal something from someone, and then later you feel convicted about it, and you decide, I'm going to give that back. You give it back plus 20%, and you also need to offer a sin offering. There's a sin offering to deal with your trespass that you've committed, your relationship to God, but there's a restitution that is 20% greater to deal with what your relationship is to your fellow man that you stole from. That's for voluntary confession. If you're caught with these goods, you pay back double. Chapter 22, verse 4, it says, if the theft is certainly found alive in his hand, whether it is an ox or donkey or sheep, he shall restore double. And you can also see that in verse 9, same kind of thing. Now, verse 1, why is it that there is at least a fourfold penalty for sale or slaughter of an animal? It is because he is covering his tracks. As long as the animal is in his possession, he could repent and return it. But sale or slaughter of that animal makes that impossible. And besides, the person may have had a very favorite animal that he misses and can never replace that animal, but it's slaughtered. And especially for an ox, because he might miss the plowing time, and therefore he misses the value of the crop. And in addition, that takes time and effort to train a new animal. Okay, you got to replace your ox. You've got to get the young animal, and you've got to spend time training that thing and getting it to do the right stuff. What should we be learning? I believe we should be learning this, that in the church, we deal differently with volunteer confessions versus confrontation confessions. In other words, if a person needs to be confronted with their sin, it needs to be dealt with in a stiffer way than if they voluntarily are dealing with their sin. But if they're voluntarily dealing with it, notice God does not say, well, thank you very much for saying you're sorry. That makes everything as if it never happened. That's important to remember. We're looking at this to understand God's mind on these kind of matters. We live in a society that is so much to think, well, I just said I'm sorry, now you should just forget everything that happened and it should make everything go back to normal just like that. These chapters make it clear that that is not God's mind. Verse 2. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. If the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Now notice this. Verse 2, a nighttime thief can be killed without penalty. Now remember, we're talking about Old Testament law. I'm not talking about what Christians should do. I hope you understand that. In the Old Testament law, a nighttime thief could be killed without penalty. Why is that? Well, there's no way of knowing, really, whether his motive was theft or murder. And often in the night, it's difficult to safely resist him or apprehend him. And besides, his identity might be uncertain. Who is that? Look how this would be a deterrent for nighttime theft. If you steal in the night, guess what? You can be killed with no penalty to the guy who kills you. So maybe a person would say to themselves, what? I would like to steal, but I am going to do it cleverly in the day. Now remember, another thing about nighttime theft, it's hard to get witnesses, hard to get help. So you can see what God is doing here as he is dealing with this issue. But a daylight thief cannot be killed. What is done there is God gives that thief personal responsibility. Now that's actually better than having him killed. You see, what God does here is he prevents somebody from murdering someone and then claiming that he was a thief. You see how these laws are dealing with things that people can twist around. In the night, it'd be hard to identify who is this trying to break in. And so, the house owner kills him. But in the daytime, you can tell who it is. And you can see how perverted human nature would sometimes deal with things like this. Somebody is very upset at a person, and when that fellow comes over, he kills him. And then said he was trying to break into my house. So I'm justified. Verse 3. Notice that this daytime thief must surely pay restitution. Well, what if he's not able to pay? What if he doesn't have anything? Then he is sold for his theft. Now, sometimes people wonder, why did God allow slavery to exist so long? Why in the New Testament wasn't slavery prohibited? I think this is part of the answer. It's because slavery is not wrong in itself. I know you're probably shocked that I would say that. And it's illustrated by this very verse. If a man steals and then doesn't have enough to pay back, God says he should be what? What's God say? Sold for his theft. He has to work it off. Now remember, there was a limitation. The Old Testament law said he could be a slave for how long? 6 years and go free on the seventh. So you see, God is just here. But listen, if you steal something and you don't have the money to pay it back, you don't have the money to pay, and notice it says he has to pay double, so you got to pay more. You got to pay back what you stole plus pay that much more again. If you don't have that money, you're going to have to be a slave for 6 years to work it off. That is a good law. We live in a society that doesn't even understand that. In other words, God is saying you are responsible for what you do, and if you violate my law, here's the consequences, and if you don't have the money to pay, then you have to work for this man or work for someone else. Maybe you work for someone else who buys you as a slave. He pays a certain amount of money, and so therefore that money would go to compensate the one who was stolen from. Verse 4, if the animal is alive in his possession, he must pay double. He restores double because that makes him return the animal he has plus pay back what he hoped to snitch. Verse 5, what if a hungry animal grazes in someone else's field? The responsibility is this. You must give restitution from the best of your own field. It reminds me of a man that I knew when I was a boy. He was a farmer, but he also worked part-time as a carpenter, and he was talking to some of his friends on the carpenter gang about how he had a neighbor that his cows would keep getting over into his field. And someone on the carpenter crew said to this farmer, said, well, why don't you let your cows over into his field? He said, there's nothing over there my cows want. You see, if a person lets his animal into someone else's field, then before God, he's responsible to compensate. Restitution from the best of his own field required. Well, here's the question. What if he doesn't have a good field? Now, from what you've read in these chapters before, what would the answer be to that if he doesn't have a good field? He would have to compensate equivalence or better in some other way, either by money or by selling some of his animals to give the guy. You understand what I'm saying? As you look at the whole passage, you realize even though God hasn't explicitly said what to do if he doesn't have a good field of his own, you can see that God's mind on the subject would teach he would need to somehow make a compensation of equivalence or better. Verse 6, he who starts a fire is responsible for all losses. It says, if a fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed, he who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. Now, what does he mean there about if it catches in thorns? Just imagine a person saying this. Well, I started a fire in this place, and I couldn't help it that it caught a few thorns over here, and then it went in the thorns for a while, and then it came out and burnt your grain. That wasn't my problem. I didn't start the fire over there. You know what God says? You started the fire. If it got out into some other stuff and then went over here and did something else, you're responsible. You can see how these laws are written to deal with the kinds of depravity that comes up again and again. You know, if you don't understand depravity and man's inclination to do evil things, go read a sample will that people write. You know, if you go to get a computer program and have it print out a sample will, and just look at the provisions in there. There are things in there that I would have never thought of. But you can tell that they are dealing with the kind of tangles people come up with to try to dispute a will, and so it explicitly puts these certain things in there to just preclude that right away. For example, I was looking at one time, and it said something to this effect. Any of my descendants that I do not mention in this will, it is intentional. Can you see what kind of issue that will-making program was making in relation to what people do? They read the will of their grandfather and they aren't mentioned. I'm sure he wanted to give me something. He just forgot. And so you can see the same kind of thing going on here. God is dealing with this and this and this, and the way he deals with it, you can see he is anticipating the kind of perverse things that human beings do. What about property disputes? Chapter 22, verse 7 and following. If you have property entrusted to you that is inanimate, in other words, it's not an animal, it can't move around, it's just a thing. If you have that kind of property that's entrusted to you, what about this situation? If a man delivers to his neighbor money or articles to keep, and it is stolen out of the man's house, if the thief is found, he shall pay double. In other words, if you know who the thief is, it's just like an ordinary theft, he has to pay double. If the thief is not found, then the master of the house shall be brought into the judges to see whether he has put his hand into his neighbor's goods. Now, you can see what's going on here. In verse 7, the thief cannot go free just because he didn't take it from the real owner. Can you imagine how people would do this? Well, I didn't take it from the owner, so how can you claim I stole it from him? I took it out of this man's house. But furthermore, this man didn't own it, so I didn't steal it from him either. And what does God say? If the thief is found, he shall what? Pay double. It doesn't matter that it's sitting in someone else's house. Now, if the thief is not found, verse 8, the master of the house shall be tried by the judges to see if he had stolen it. You see, it could be that there's a situation where the master of the house is sort of working this out. Verse 9, in any kind of dispute over property, whether it's inanimate or not, both parties will be brought to the judges, and whoever they condemn shall pay double to the other. Now, there's some kind of dispute. Okay, we're going to take it to the judges, and they have to investigate it carefully and make a decision. And on the basis of their decision, whoever is regarded as guilty, he has to pay double to the other. In other words, that would stop a lot of frivolous complaints, wouldn't it? Verses 10 to 13, there's responsibility for animate entrusted property. If animals have been entrusted to you, if there's a loss by unknown causes, verses 10 and 11, there's an oath before God and there's no restitution to be made. However, if someone put an animal in your care and it's stolen, you have to restore it, verse 12. That eliminates collusion with a thief. You can see how, again, people would do this kind of thing. Somebody puts an animal in your care, and you think, hey, I see the way to deal with this. I'm not going to steal this animal, but I have a friend who's very good at it, and I'll just let him know there's an extra animal here, and he takes the animal, and he'll give me, you know, 20 shekels or whatever for helping him out, and I couldn't help it. This animal got stolen. God says, if somebody delivers this into your care and that animal is stolen, you pay. If it's torn to pieces, you bring evidence that it was torn to pieces and no restitution is required. Verses 14 and 15. What about borrowing? Borrowing in the absence of the owner. If something happens in the absence of the owner, there must be full restitution. The borrower must assume full responsibility, even if not at fault. Oh, that tells us something, doesn't it? You know, if someone borrows a piece of equipment and as he's using it, it breaks, what does this suggest? He's responsible to restore the equipment. That's what I would see as a suggestion. What about if the owner is present with it? Then there is no restitution because it says it came for hire. In other words, if the owner is right there with that donkey that's being used and he sees how you've loaded it and he doesn't do anything about it, then it isn't a problem. That would suggest maybe that in a sense it's sort of like the situation that we would call renting. Verses 16 and 17. Here's the issue of the seduction of unbetrothed virgins. Notice that if a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. Now, there again, you can see how God is dealing with how humans like to manipulate things. You see, if an unbetrothed virgin has been seduced, the man must pay the bride price and marry her. And also, from other passages, you'll find that he could never divorce her, even though divorce is permitted in the Old Testament. But in this case, he could never divorce her. In other words, listen, guys, this is not just a fling. It has lifelong consequences. That's what he's saying. You know, if a man does to a virgin what is only to be done for a wife, then he has to assume the full responsibility of doing the rest of the things that a man should be doing for his wife. Well, what if the father realizes this man is an absolute worthless scoundrel and that having him marry this daughter won't help one thing? What if he realizes that? The bride price is still required, but the father can say, no way, you're not marrying her. That's only going to make things worse. But notice, the virgin bride price is required. You see, this man can claim, well, she's not a virgin. Yeah, why isn't she a virgin? Because he seduced her, that's why. God says, you can't pay for her as if she's second-class goods. You pay for her as if she's a virgin still. Verses 18 to 20. Perversion requires execution. Any sorceress, any person who has sexual relations with a beast, sacrifice to any god except the Lord God alone. And then verses 21 to 27, there is a prohibition against taking advantage of the weak. He refers to strangers. Remember your time in Egypt. He refers to widows and orphans. If this person mistreats a widow or orphan, and the widow or orphan cries to God at all, God will hear, and God says, I'll deal with you. In other words, kill you and make your wives and children like them. What about the issue of lending money to poor brethren? There was to be no interest required. And pledges were to be returned before sundown because he needs a sleeping cloak. And if you don't do this, his cry to God against you will be heard. Now the context is clearly speaking about abject poverty. This fellow has so little that he needs his cloak to sleep in. This is not talking about investment for business. I'm just saying that for clarity. So there's some understanding here. You see how God avenges oppression of the weak. You know, as a Christian employer or as a Christian leader, you take advantage of people. Notice again, this is focused on local situations. It's easy to wax eloquent about what should be done over in Afghanistan or Somalia or some other place, isn't it? But, oh, God wants us to think about what's going on right in our own setting. And then verses 28 to 31, relationship to God. You're not to curse God or his representative. You're not to delay offering produce or your firstborn child to God. The firstborn of an animal is to be kept with the mother 7 days. And then holy men are not to eat torn flesh. So what are some moral lessons that we should be learning from Exodus 21 and 22? One of the things we can learn is look at this and understand some things about child training. 21 verse 15, respect for parents is vitally important in God's eyes. I think if you look at the word that's used there, about cursing parents, it's not merely a curse, but evil speaking in general. Lenient parents are not teaching forbearance, but a false view of authority and a false view ultimately of God. And so, as parents, what do we learn? Penalties for misbehavior of children should be appropriate for the offense. They've got to be severe enough to make it worthwhile, but not overly severe. And you know, people fail on both sides of that issue. And reading these things that God says about penalties helps us understand how to deal with children. Notice also that the result of wrong behavior must be on the offender. And I believe parents can learn some things there in teaching their child, you know what, you did this thing, and because you did it, it caused this kind of problem, and now you are going to have to deal with that problem. You're going to have the trouble. For example, if your little child is walking out in the mud, and you told him, now, you remember when you come in, you take your shoes off, and he didn't take his shoes off, he just came walking right into the kitchen with these old muddy shoes, and it makes a mess. What would this law suggest the parent should do? Send him out to play with new shoes and clean it up yourself? I don't think so. You help that child say, listen, you did this, it had these effects, now you need to help clean this up. It's your job. I'll show you how to do it. Now get busy, start cleaning this up. You see, the brunt of that falls on the child. Now, of course, you have to use discretion and wisdom. If a four-year-old throws a ball through the window, a bay window of some kind that's very expensive, you can't say, well, I'm going to hold you responsible for that, and I'll charge you whatever it costs to replace it, and I'll charge you compound interest on it until you're old enough to earn the money. The poor guy would sink deeper and deeper into debt. You understand, God expects you to use wisdom, but as you look at this, I believe that children should be taught responsibility. So general ingredients of punishment which parents should remember. There is some punishment for the offense. There's compensation to the injured party. There's a purging of guilt, confession of things. There's deterrence of similar crimes. You know, God puts these things in here, and he isn't saying this is an exhaustive list. I'm telling you this so that you can apply it and think about it and realize that it includes more other kinds of things of similar nature. And so if you tell your child you mustn't do this thing, and they turn around and don't do that exact same thing, you know, you tell them, don't run as you're going from this room to the next room. And they said, well, I didn't run, I just skipped. You see what's happening there? The child is learning legalistic maneuvering instead of getting the principle right. And then, of course, there's the restoration of the offender. God has provision in here how the offender can be restored. Very important. Notice also the importance of immediate action. In secular courts, sometimes the trial drags on so long before it actually gets resolved. Sometimes those things happen in the church, too, where things are not resolved and they drag on. I believe God's idea is one where we deal with things promptly and deal decisively with it. You see, as you read these chapters, you find the judges are to investigate and get the answer that's correct and take appropriate action. You can see how this is so important when we come to a New Testament passage, Matthew 18, where there's something been done wrong, and so a person goes to the person who's wronged him by himself at first. Then the second stage, he takes one or two brethren with him. And notice these two other brethren that he is to take with him are not making a private investigation of their own. They three are going together. It's essentially a court case to decide what the truth is. And if the person who's been investigated says, well, yes, but you have problems, that can be a separate issue. But you cannot muddy the issue regarding that person. That could be a separate case. This case has to be dealt with on the issue at hand. And then every word is established, the case is decided, and if there's no hearing, it's taken to the church, not to decide whether this is right or wrong, but to appeal to the erring brother to repent. Now, as we've looked at some of these verses in chapter 21 and 22, let's have a little discussion. What do you think? If there's a brother in the church who has been caught in theft, what should be done? In other words, as we look at these passages and try to learn what is God's mind on this subject or that subject, and now let's say there's a brother in the church that has been caught with theft. What should be done? What's that? Okay, repayment should be made. Repayment should be made. I think that's certainly true. Anybody want to comment on the details of repayment? Now remember, we don't want to view this in a legalistic manner. We're trying to understand the mind of God in these things. It's not that we are under the Old Testament law, but you can see that there is an interplay going on here between forgiveness and restitution. There are some principles here. Forgive means to restore the relationship, but restitution means to restore losses. Those are two different things. You notice when God deals with it, there's a separation between those things. You have to restore losses, but also we know from other passages in the Old Testament that you have to bring your sin offering. See, that's separate from the restoring of losses. I'd like you to turn to Numbers chapter 5, verses 6 to 8. He says, "Speak to the children of Israel, when a man or woman commits any sin that men commit in unfaithfulness against the Lord, and that person is guilty." So they've sinned against God. "Then he shall confess the sin which he has committed. He shall make restitution for his trespass in full, plus one-fifth of it, and give it to the one he has wronged." Isn't that interesting? He's committed a trespass against God, but he also needs to make restitution to the one he's wronged. You see, it's not just a case of saying, "I did this wrong thing, God, will you forgive me?" That's important. He has to not only confess his sin to God, but make restitution to the one that's wronged. Then in verse 6, "But if the man has no relative to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest in addition to the ram of the atonement with which atonement is made for him." It's not like you can just say, "Oh, sorry, God, there was a sacrifice that needs to be made to get the relationship right with God, and then there's a restitution that needs to be made to make the relationship right with your fellow man." You see, forgiveness required the sacrifice of an innocent substitute, which pointed forward to Christ, the innocent substitute who died for us. In other words, God is providing a substitute to pay what the guilty could never pay, but restitution was required in addition to the substitute. Now, if no relative was available to receive the restitution, it needed to go to the priest. Evidently, the thing pictured there in verse 6 is a case of where the person that was stolen from, for example, had already died, and there was no kinsman redeemer that could receive the money or whatever it was, then it would go to the priest. What is the principle? God freely provides substitute for what the guilty cannot pay. God requires the guilty to pay what he can, that is, restore the losses. Incidentally, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus contrasted retributive lex talionis, you know, the eye for an eye and tooth for tooth. He was not speaking particularly of restitution. You see, when it says eye for eye and tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, you know, if somebody maims you, then the retribution is limited to maiming him in the foot, the same foot. He is not talking about restitution there of something like theft. Illustration from Zacchaeus, Luke 19, verses 8 and 9. Notice that Zacchaeus actually utilized the principle of Exodus 22:1, Now, Zacchaeus, of course, was living at the time before Jesus' death, and so he was living in the Old Testament era. There is nothing explicit in the law about tax collectors. And yet Zacchaeus applied the law and said, if I have taken anything by false accusation, I restore fourfold. You see what Zacchaeus is doing? This happened when he met the Lord. And what did Jesus say on that response? He said, this day salvation has come to this house. In other words, it was evidence of true repentance. So, God expects people in the church to judge among themselves on disputed issues. How do we know that? 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Paul reprimands the Corinthians because they went to court before unbelievers to resolve their conflicts. And he said, aren't there any people of wisdom among you? In other words, the church should have people who can judge between what's going on and decide what is the right thing to do in these matters. And their attitude needs to be not vindictive, not putting somebody into hopeless bondage. You know, the unforgiving servant in Matthew 18. Don't want to be in that. Remember the hopeless debt that Christ provides forgiveness for every sinner, and the procedure. Well, what if he can't pay? Let's say he stole something. Then I think it would be right for church people to set up a schedule for payment, monitored by the deacons. And maybe the first portion of his paycheck needs to go to the restitution fund. You see, you're helping the brother. So many times the people that need the most help do not get the help that is truly significant. They are simply helped to continue on in their false ways. Well, what about this thing in the Old Testament where 20% extra is required to be returned for theft? What about if that happens in the brotherhood? Here are some considerations. Remember Galatians 6, 1 and 2. The goal is spiritual restoration. And possibly it would help him tremendously in his spiritual restoration if he realizes that you cannot just go and say, sorry, here it is back. You have to cost yourself a little extra because of what you've done. But there may be times when it's the appropriate thing to totally forgive the debt. You're going to have to learn that and understand that through this working of the Spirit of God and learning how to have the mind of God to understand these things. At other times, it may be necessary to have more consequences. And spiritual discernment is going to be required to understand what to do in each case. But we need the background of these Old Testament laws to help us understand how God thinks about things. That's why it's important to immerse ourselves in this book, not only the New Testament, but also the Old Testament. Remember, in Timothy it says, these things in the Old Testament are profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness, so that we can be perfect. Not that we are legally bound to the details of these regulations, because we know from the New Testament we're made free from the law, dead to the law through the body of Christ. But nevertheless, the law is instructive to us. May God bless you.